Welcome to What Makes Up Your Mind? Updates from the frontiers of neuroscience, well-being, and mental health from the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University's School of Medicine. This is your invitation to meet the faculty dedicated to understanding our most complex organ, committed to curing mental illness, and inspired to help create a healthier, thriving world. Hi, we're glad you're back with us on What Makes Up Your Mind. I'm Jane McMillan. In this episode, we look deep inside the human brain with Dr. Tamar Green as she works to unlock genetic answers to neuropsychiatric disorders. A child psychiatrist, researcher, and assistant professor in the Stanford Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, Dr. Green is coming at the challenges of childhood conditions like attention deficit, hyperactivity, and autism spectrum disorders from a different angle. Dr. Green is tracing the cause of neurodevelopmental disorders by mapping their genetic pathways and finding the actual biology of these conditions. As Dr. Green says, once the cause is known, better treatments follow. Right now, the work in her BRIDGE lab, which stands for Brain Imaging Development and Genetics, is focused on studying two rare childhood syndromes, Noonan's and neurofibromatosis 1, or NF1. This in order to unlock the key to medical intervention for many others. So while Dr. Green and her team zero in on genes, the tiny, minuscule sections of DNA found in every human cell, her work actually carries big, broad implications for tackling a whole collection of childhood neurodisorders. And you might be in a position to help with her research. So let's find out more. Dr. Tamar Green, we're so glad to have you on What Makes Up Your Mind. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. I'm very glad to be here.
What you do, I find so exciting. And as I was kind of reading up on it and trying to, as a layperson, not a medical person, trying to understand what I came away with, and you tell me if I'm off base or not, but what I came away with is that you are a detective, or maybe another way of, you're a map maker, a cartographer, and your area of discovery or sleuthing is neurogenetics. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's nice. It's analogy. I have never thought about it this way, but yes, I can definitely, it's fair to say.
Okay, good. Well, because as we were talking beforehand, you were telling me how what you do is take a condition, and rather than trying to map out the symptoms or the pathology of that condition, you are mapping out the genetics that lead to this condition. So yeah, just give us a little overview of that.
Yes. So I'm a child psychiatrist by training, and naturally I'm taking care of disorders that I think everyone knows, autism spectrum disorders and ADHD, issues with attention. The thing is with these disorders is that we define them by how the child behaves. What it means that there's a lot of many factors that come into that. And then when I think as a scientist and I'm trying to understand why this child presents with these symptoms, it's going to be really hard for me to detect what is the process that causes this. So if I'm going back to your analogy, what I do, I actually flip things around. And it's a method that it's not only me doing, but several labs across basically the world, is that we start with the genetics, call it genetic first. So instead of start investigating a bunch of kids with ADHD or autism, we flip it and we start with children that have a specific genetic change. And then we track it, as you said, you know, we map it and look what this gene is doing to the brain, how the brain development is affected and different than a child without this mutation, and then how, with what behavioral issues these children present with, and how can we connect all these dots basically to create a better map of what's going on for this specific gene or collection of genes that work together, what we call the pathway.
What does that tell you that's different from approaching it the other way? What different insight does it give you in terms of interventions or ways to understand maybe the development of other kinds of neurodevelopmental issues?
Yeah. So even think about the syndromes that I'm studying now, I think they give a really good example for that, because usually when we treat symptoms, we have our medications that are actually pretty good. If we think about attention, for example, medications are pretty good. For autism, as I think many people are aware, the interventions are not that helpful. And what's very different about this approach is that when you think and give those medication, you give them based on symptoms. So you basically do not change anything in the biology, or not addressing any specific biological issue. And when you start from the genetics, what might happen, in not always, and sometimes it's in theory, but sometimes it's getting closer and closer to actual intervention, is that, for example, I'm studying a collection of syndromes called drosopathy, and this collection of genes affect a biological pathway that's called RAS and APK pathway. And this pathway is hyperactivated. It's too active on these kids. And some of these kids develop tumors in the body because of that. So today, and children get a medication that suppresses this activation of the pathway and attenuate the growth of these tumors. In the same manner, the reason this child presents with a lot of psychiatric symptoms is the same reason. And theoretically, we can use these medications to treat the actual cause. And this is a situation that today we do not have in psychiatry. So this is why I think it's so exciting to kind of like do science this way.
Okay, so if I'm understanding it correctly, mapping the pathways of these syndromes helps you understand how they manifest physically, as in with the tumors in the example you just gave. So then neurogenetic mapping of them gives you another insight into how the syndrome's psychiatric symptoms might also be intervened or addressed. Am I getting that right?
Yes, it's basically when I study these kids and I know and I map what's happening in their brain. And today I have a medication that can attenuate the activation of the pathway. Now, we have not done this connection yet for psychiatric manifestation in these disorders, but this connection already been done for tumors. So we understand that we know that these medications are already pretty safe, and we know that they what they do. And the next step is probably to test them for, let's say, a manifestation of autism in a child with those syndromes. So what's the? I just will put it in contrast. When you have so much knowledge about the pathophysiology, about what's going on under the hood, you have much more power to be very specific with your interventions. I'll give a very simple example. A child can have pneumonia, and if we don't know what's going on, we basically can give him Tylenol to reduce the fever. But if we do know the bacteria that causes the disease and the pneumonia, so we can give him antibiotics and cure that. So this is not where we are in psychiatry. And this is, in my opinion, the one step towards that, towards understanding what's going on under the hood in terms of the genetics and in terms of the brain development, and be able to have much more targeted intervention, if it makes sense.
It makes perfect sense, yeah. Maybe this is a good time just to talk about the basics of genetics. I mean, I think all of us understand how we get physical, visible traits from our families, you know, height, eye color, hair color, they're displayed, and we know they're inherited. And then, of course, there are the medical conditions that we may be at risk of due to heredity.
Mm-hmm.
But how does this work in neurodevelopment? Do we know how we derive our neurogenes, if that's the right term, and do we know why they mutate sometimes?
I think we can think about two different scenarios that I think it's important to explain them. So when I think about neurogenetic conditions, I usually refer to a mutation that happened in one gene or what we call a deletion or duplication of one of a chunk of genes, like a chunk of the chromosomes that in our DNA, chromosome it just means that it's a structure of many, many, many genes. So those mutations are causing a very large effect. Like it's one mutation that causes a large effect. And then a child with genetic condition will have usually manifestation not only in their like presenting with ADHD or effect on their cognition or autism, but they also will have many times problems with their heart or issues with height. So it's usually something that is kind of like a big genetic event that happened and affect multiple systems. And this is the type of work that we do, and we do see large effects on the brain. Like then we can detect it quite easily. On the contrast, when we talk about or think about neurodevelopmental conditions like ADHD and ASD, these ones are much more similar to what you said about, let's say, hereditary diabetes type 2 or hypertension. Probably what's happening is that we have a collection of genes. Each one of them has a small effect on the manifestation. And if a child has a collection of many genes with small effect, that kind of like accumulates to a large effect, so they will present with ASD. Or will present with ADHD. So it's different. Both of them are genetic, but they are genetic in a different way. Because what's fascinating is that for me, when I assess many times a child for ADHD, most of the time one of the parents will have themselves struggled with attention. So and what's probably happened is that this parent has this kind of like accumulation of many, many, many small genes that caused that, and they were kind of like inherited to their child. Yeah. I don't know if it's like already too complicated, but.
Well, it is, yes. And that's why we have people like you working on it. It is very complex. But as you mentioned to me, some genes are novel or non-inherited, and some are. So yeah. is that the same kind of 50-50 split in the genes in our neurodevelopment?
When we have these mutations in the syndromes that I'm studying that happen because of one gene, a mutation in one gene, half of the cases are caused what we call de novo, like new. It happened in utero to this child, but the parents did not give it to him. And half of the cases are inherited. And what happens many times is that the child is being diagnosed and then the parent is diagnosed. Like not all the time is the parent even aware that they have this condition, which is interesting because, you know, parents grew up in a different time with different environment, medical system. So sometimes they only being diagnosed because their kids being diagnosed.
So I'm anxious to talk about what work you're doing in your lab. But before we move on, and this question may be a little bit out there, but because we were just talking about how do we know how genes mutate or why they do, the next obvious question is how close are we to fixing that at a genetic level? And we've heard about the CRISPR gene editing, a couple of hundred people, I think. It's been tested on for inherited diseases like muscle degeneration and maybe treating cancer. But I mean, what would that look like in doing genetic work in the brain? Are we even looking at that, or is that such a different animal?
It's a great question. It's outside of my field, but I can definitely apply what we know that might explain why it's not going to be the first thing that we'll solve. If you can change a gene and kind of restore it or edit it, the effect is going to be easier if the kind of like organs that this gene affect going to be something that renew during our life. A great example going to be blood cells. Most of our blood cells being born and die during our life many, many times. So gene editing in those type of conditions that affect blood cells are in a way like the low hanging fruit for this kind of interventions, because during the lifetime you can intervene and then there's new cells that are being created. Mm-hmm. But with the brain, as you can assume, it's trickier because of the reason that it's a developing organ and it's a very complex organ. And if you think about it, we have the gene in each cell of the brain. If you edit the gene at any step after development, these cells already exist. So in a way, kind of like replacing the cells that already been there, which is difficult, right?
It sounds impossible.
Huge challenge.
But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we have a much better shot to bypass and fix what this gene is like not doing, for example, or in terms of the brain.
Yeah, with medical intervention rather than editing.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Let's talk about then what you're doing in your lab. It's called the Bridge Lab, the Brain Imaging Development and Genetic Lab. Talk about what you do in the lab. And what I find so wonderful about your lab is that you have patients, children in your case, physically coming in. A lot of times we think about a lab with, you know, test tubes and, but you've got kids coming in.
Yeah. So I'll just tell you about our days. The population of children that we study are a rare population because these mutations, it's a good thing that they don't happen so much. What we actually do, we have a huge operation that brings the kids with the genetic condition to us, which means that we fly them in many times and they come here for 2 days with their family. And we spend time in the lab doing like different games and assessment and questions about how we kind of trying to figure out how the brain works. A major kind of a component of our research is to do brain imaging, basically taking pictures of the brain. So we're interested both in how the brain is structured and then trying to figure out how it's different or affected. And we're also interested in how the brain is functioning. So we have these techniques to evaluate that as well. And I have to say that the kids are super brave because it's a lot. All the things that I describe is very intense days. Also, they contribute their time and their energy, and parents take time off work. So we hugely appreciate that. We're also trying to give back and doing a lot of webinars and sessions that we then try to share with the same population that participated our results, and trying to think what can they benefit now for their child. And one of the things that we do is to also give them a report from all our findings and all the things that we saw that can help them understand their child better, which we find it very beneficial to families.
Your work, as you said, concentrates right now on a very narrow population. But as we talked about earlier, this process of gene mapping and understanding that will have implications for all kinds of neuro conditions. But explain why you zero in on children with Noonan syndrome for the work you're doing now as a population to study, figure out this gene mapping and a better way to address neurodevelopment issues. What is Noonan syndrome?
So I'll explain about two syndromes, Noonan syndrome and NF1 or fibromatosis 1. Noonan syndrome is a change in one gene. It causes this pathway to be hyperactive. And actually, both syndromes cause the same thing. Both of them, because of different gene and different changes, but they're kind of like, you can think about them as a family. And the kids with Noonan syndrome usually will present with short stature and some cardiac issues with their heart. And in what interests me is that they will have many times difficulties and weaknesses in attention, and they might present with elevated difficulties in social communication. Some of them can even present with symptoms of autism. in terms of what they present with clinically, it's similar, but we're actually discovering that the brains of the kids with Noonan syndrome and NF1 are very different. But you asked me about why is it important. So one thing, it's very, very important to the families of these kids. It's a rare condition, and NF1 is 1 to 3,000, and Noonan is 1 to 2,000. Understanding what's going on in terms of psychiatric manifestation is extremely important. Many parents, after the initial diagnosis and handling the most severe physical symptoms that the kids can present with, usually after the first few years, the thing that most concerned of is about cognitive development and mental health. So I see it's very, very important. But how it can benefit a larger populations is by they teach us a lot, because they teach us how different pathways can be related to autism, for example. Eventually, there's a limited number of pathways that are gonna be involved in those syndromes. And mapping this pathway, for example, will help us understand what's happening when this pathway is malfunctioning. And then there's probably gonna be another pathway that can be mapped with other kind of syndromes. And little by little, you can get a much better understanding of the bigger picture of the larger population of children with autism, for example. So This is how I think about it.
Yeah. As you mentioned, in terms of population in the country, very few have these two syndromes that you are focusing on in how to map and recognize genetic mutations, but the implications are much, much larger. And just the feeling of connection for the families of these children who are probably very isolated in their challenges with these conditions. So coming together with other families and other children and having that information from you through the lab must be just a lifeline.
Yes, I think just the situation that you know, you're very different, you look differently. Even when the parents come to school and say, oh, my child has NF1, no one knows what it is. So having someone that is very interested in what you have and the manifestation that, you know, not the obvious one, not the kids with NF1 have a huge problem with tumors. So most of the physicians that see them focus on that, but to have someone that understands how you might learn and how you might have difficulties finding friends is our quality of life and our, the reason we're here for. So I think it's very important.
Of course, it is. As a psychiatrist, you wear two hats. You're a researcher and you're also a physician, a clinician. In your role as a psychiatric clinician, and you're seeing these families, and we're talking about heredity in some instances, do you help them with any, or is there any guilt or regret, or how did I not know? I mean, that just seems to me would be an automatic feeling, but such a terrible burden on top of having a child with a challenge. So how do you help them navigate that? Or what would you say to them to assuage any guilt?
Yeah. The thing is that what I find as a child psychiatrist in general, and also honestly in my own life with my own kids, is that I think very generally once your child struggles, and no matter if it's something you know you kind of like gave him through your genes, or I don't even like the expression gave him, because of course it's not a choice there. So I think guilt is there anyways. It's very surprising to understand that, but it's, I think, inherited in us as parents. There's the usual things to explain that it's not your choice. You kind of bring them to the world and you have very little control over the mixture that they're going to get. But what I'm trying to focus more with parents, I think what guilt does, it makes you suffer, but it also makes you to take the attention from parenting or being able to be there for your child. I would recommend really focusing on that and processing that in therapy, or I think many times religious or some beliefs can also help with that, to really explore that and understand and see how it can affect the way you treat your child, and kind of go from that aspect, because it's going to be really beneficial for your child if you're not guilty about it and you just, you know, take it on like anything else in life that just happens. It doesn't matter if it's your genes that went to them or it's something that happened, you know, de novo. Anyway, you're going to feel very guilty.
Yeah.
As a parent.
As a parent, sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
If somebody is listening and is interested in learning more about becoming part of what you do at the lab, is there a way for people to apply to have their child come to the lab and be part of your study?
We are definitely open, and we're currently recruiting kids with Noonan syndrome. We're seeing all types of Noonans. There's a lot of types. We are waiting on more funding from NF1, so yes, definitely. If you're interested, please look us up. It's very helpful to do that. And also, if you want to be part of our studies and what we call typically developing without a genetic condition and you're from the Bay Area, we'll be very happy to see you as well. We need a control group. Yeah.
Right. That's great to know. Well, we're going to put that link information in our podcast notes. So anyone's interested, all you have to do is check those notes. One thing you said to me, Dr. Green, that I just thought really brings it home to help people know that there are doctors like you working away in labs, and it's not a distant thing. These developments are happening right now that could change everything. And you said you love it because it's research that is actual life.
Mm-hmm.
You and your team every day walk in and you've got actual patients there, and you know you're getting close to something that's going to alter life quality.
That's the hope. You know, being a physician scientist, I think this is where I want to be. That hopefully also helps.
Dr. Green, thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Tamar Green, a Stanford child and adolescent psychiatrist, researching the genetic causes of childhood neurodevelopmental disorders. If you'd like to know more about Dr. Green's work, support it, or participate in the research at her Bridge Lab, we have all those links in our podcast notes. We really hope that knowing scientists like Dr. Green are at work every day looking for the causes and solutions to these conditions gives you hope for a better future for all kids. Come back again for more news from the ever-evolving research in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences of Stanford University. It's on What Makes Up Your Mind. I'm Jane McMillan. You've been listening to What Makes Up Your Mind? Updates from the frontiers of neuroscience, well-being, and mental health from the experts in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine. For more information on this program and all of our transformational work, visit us at med.stanford.edu/psychiatry. What Makes Up Your Mind? Updates from the frontiers of neuroscience, well-being, and mental health is a production of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine, a copyright of the Board of Trustees of Stanford University.